cracking wallpaper of our reality, there exists another world that science has yet to explain. In here dwell monsters and madness, and potentially the answers to our most important questions. In this world, gravity intensifies, time slows down, and your heart rate quickens. I'm Jake Rokitansky.
And I'm Brad Abrahams.
And you're listening to The Spectral Voyager. For today's episode, we're going to be talking about time travel. Now, for those who know me, you know this is one of my most cherished topics. You know, it appears in some of my favorite movies from growing up, obviously the Back to the Future series, but also stranger films like Time Crimes and television shows like Dark. You know, I've always just been fascinated, not necessarily with the concept of time travel, but actually the method in which somebody achieves it. I love seeing artists' representations of the machine, what it looks like, what it does, how does it work. And so today we're going to be talking about the very strange case of Mike Madman Markham. Now, this is a story you might have heard before. It went pretty viral on social media a couple months ago, I believe on TikTok, and people were talking about it. But what I've prepared for you today is a very comprehensive look at Mad Mike's journey, from beginning to end. But before we get started, Julian, welcome to your first appearance on The Spectral Voyager.
Thank you, Jake. I've actually appeared on a future episode, and so this is my second or I think even third. I can't remember very well because obviously the timelines are crossing in my head, but I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. And you're a time travel enthusiast, right?
Yeah, I've been trying to get the technology to work at home. I want to travel forward to my deathbed.
Fair enough. And Brad, what about you? I mean, in all of your sort of esoteric explorations, have you ever really kind of hit on something time travel related that got, like, you know, stuck in your craw and, you know, lingered in your brain for longer than a minute or so?
Why, yes. There's actually two cases that I think are irrefutable that I think are going to act as a good primer before we get into this episode.
Sure. Yeah. Go for it.
And it's about these two pieces of technology that I've been researching.
Cool.
Instead of sending people themselves into different space times, they instead transmit imagery from the past into the now.
Oh.
Yeah. So.
Yes. Color me intrigued.
So, Father Pellegrino Ernetti was a respected Roman Catholic priest of the Benedictine order. He was a famed exorcist, but his passion was archaic music. While experimenting on techniques of filtering out harmonics from Gregorian chants, he and Father Augusto Gemelli said they heard Gemelli's dead father speaking back on the recorder afterwards. Intrigued, Ernetti wondered if all the sights and sounds humans made throughout history stuck around somehow. Sometime in the 50s, he secretly assembled a crack team of scientists, including Enrico Fermi and Wernher von Braun, to figure it out.
Oh, boy.
The result was what they called a chronovisor.
Oh, great, great band name. Oh, my God. Hey, if you're looking for a name, I'll bet somebody's already got it, probably. But if they don't, you better take that name, and you better make something synthy and dope.
And you better be a Nazi.
The chronovisor was a sort of television that could tune into any event from any time. Ernetti insisted that it worked, saying,
"We saw everything. The agony in the garden. The betrayal of Judas. The trial. Calvary."
But because he never showed the device to anyone, skepticism grew. He was urged to produce some proof, and that he did. One of the two pieces he provided was an actual photo of Jesus dying on the cross. Astounding. And there's the photo there. For both of you to see.
That is, irrefutable.
I mean, it almost sort of looks like a wooden mask with a painted face on it.
Well, yes, so it was soon exposed as just a closely cropped photo of a wooden carving of Jesus that was flipped from left to right. So after this debacle, the church told him to just shut up about it, and it seemed to fade into history. But according to Ernetti, the real reason was that he and his team voluntarily dismantled it because it would be too much power in the wrong hands, like, say, a Hitler or, you know, some kind of fascist leader to have this power.
Sure.
But according to an anonymous source claiming to have been a relative of Ernetti, Ernetti did confess on his deathbed that the artifacts were fake, but insisted that the chronovisor did indeed work.
Wow. That's good stuff.
So that makes sense. Yeah. I mean, it worked, but, you know, maybe the proof didn't really look like great proof, yeah, and they were concerned of being, you know, called out as fraud. So they tried to create a more believable piece of fake evidence, which unfortunately seems like that also didn't work out for them.
Yeah, when something works, you want to create a fake piece of evidence and then continue to claim it still does work.
Moving over to the epicenter of paranormal technology, we meet director of the Geophysical Laboratory of Voronezh, Russia, Genrikh Mikhailovich Silanov. Similar to Ernetti, Silanov believed that people, places, and events from the past are forever preserved in a sort of field memory. And considering that everything we see with the human eye is technically from the past because of the time it takes for light to travel, would the concept of seeing scenes from the past really be all that impossible? We all know that the stars we see in the sky above, for example, are from a long time ago. He stumbled upon this idea while trying to improve camera equipment for filming invisible UFOs.
Okay.
He invented what he called a retro camera to photograph these memories of the field. But of course, and for obvious reasons, he kept the technology a secret. However, he did reveal some of the underlying concepts to a reporter.
Photographic film is sharper than the human eye in the ultraviolet and infrared spectral ranges. A lot of information inaccessible to us can be found in a narrow band of the ultraviolet region of the spectrum near the lower limit of the visible range. The most important parts of a retro camera are a special lens and a plate or film where there is practically no gelatin layer that delays the passage of ultraviolet waves.
The photos from the camera are very murky and open to interpretation, the most famous of which is below, which is claimed to be that of a Czech soldier from the Great Patriotic War, 50 years in the past from when the photo was taken.
Yeah.
That looks like,
it's something.
Looks like an elephant.
Looks like he has two noses.
Yeah, he's like a two-nose elephant.
It's maybe a bit of a leap that they ascribed that this was somehow a Czech soldier from the Great Patriotic War. But who knows? I'm not a historian.
Me neither.
You're not an elephant expert either.
And so to sort of end this little section on the retro camera, it should be noted that all of the info that I found about it was on an enthusiast sport fishing website from Russia.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes, you know.
Checks out.
You know, big things come in small packages, you know.
Yeah. To this day, neither of these technologies have been proven false.
Yeah. I mean, hearing about Italian time travel just makes me think I would probably actually travel back to like 2006, a little bit before the final of the World Cup, and give the entire Italian soccer team COVID.
Well, that is if the virus could survive time travel. You don't know that.
I don't.
The gravity alone could, you know, just make it disintegrate.
I'd settle for just pushing that the Materazzi who screwed with Zidane on his final game down the stairs.
Well, the following story does contain a time travel device, but it's a little bit different than the two that you've described here, Brad. This one was built over the course of many years and with the help of many donors and volunteers. And so without further ado, let's get into the story of Mike Madman Markham. The day was January 20th, 1995. The song Creep by TLC was the number one song in the United States, and The Hot Zone by Richard Preston was the best-selling book. And in the small town of Stanbury, situated north of Kansas City, Missouri, Sheriff Eugene Lupfer was on his way to check on a routine call. A resident living on East 3rd Street had called the local police to complain that someone had shot a BB gun round through their sliding glass door. When the police arrived at the scene to check out the damage, they were able to quickly trace the origin of the BB to a small house directly across the street. But as soon as they crossed to see if the perpetrator was still hiding out at the residence, they noticed something odd. On the back porch, one of the officers could just make out what looked like an electrical transformer. The piece of machinery was clearly industrial grade and looked about 4 feet high. Something clicked. The police had been getting a number of complaints over the last couple weeks concerning electrical surges in the area. In addition to that, there had also been a recent blackout spanning an entire two-block radius. One of the officers on the scene, Tom Hampton, cruised back to police headquarters and began cold-calling all of the factories and electrical plants in the surrounding areas. Was anyone missing a transformer? Turns out, someone was missing a couple. St. Joseph Light and Power confirmed to Hampton that 6 transformers had been stolen recently from their King City location earlier in the month. This was enough evidence to procure a search warrant, and that evening, at approximately 11 p.m., eight police officers approached the residence. What they found inside shocked them. No pun intended.
Wow.
The residence didn't look like someone's home at all, but rather a mad scientist's lab. They instantly recognized one of the stolen Transformers sitting in the center of the living room, but on closer inspection, they saw that the thing was being used as a piggy bank to store pennies.
Dude.
In an adjacent bedroom, they located the four remaining Transformers, in addition to dozens of other homemade electrical gadgets, including an electric cigarette lighter made out of pieces from a microwave oven.
That's a real downgrade.
Fucking rad.
Jesus.
On the back porch of the residence, the authorities found the last Transformer. It was hooked up to two large metal rods standing about 4 feet high, a crude version of what's commonly referred to as a Jacob's ladder. If you're not familiar with the term, you're certainly familiar with the device, a V-shaped contraption that allows an arc of electricity to travel upwards between the rods before appearing again at the bottom. Think Dr. Frankenstein's lab. In this case, however, whoever had built this thing had wired it into the home's fuse box, tapping into the neighborhood's main line of electricity.
Oh my God.
As the officers continued to search the house, they eventually found the object's inventor, curled up next to a stove, sound asleep, was 21-year-old Michael Markham, an electrical engineering college dropout who was currently working at a cardboard box factory in Albany.
The cardboard box factory.
Mm-hmm.
Markham awoke to eight police officers standing over him, and then was promptly arrested and hauled down to the Gentry County Jail, or the Albany Hilton, as the officers affectionately referred to it. When the arresting officers asked what a young guy was doing with all that equipment, Markham told them that he was building a time machine.
Mm-hmm.
Oddly enough, their first question wasn't how, but why. Markham then explained he was hoping to travel a couple of days into the future, snag some winning lottery tickets, and then return to the present. If he became wealthy, he could further fund his experiments. In the small town of Stanbury, a 21-year-old kid getting arrested for stealing spare parts for his time machine garnered quite a bit of interest, as you can imagine, and a handful of local papers covered Markham's arrest and trial. And I have a screenshot here of one of the articles, and the headline is, "Time Travel Not Likely, Scientists Say."
Oh, come on.
What a bummer.
Yeah.
A factory worker's foray into time travel could have killed him, they say. And it's from the Associated Press.
I'm still thinking about the BB. Was he just like taking break from making time travel machine to shoot BBs into a nearby building?
Here's what happened. So a friend of his was over and okay. He was playing with a BB gun.
Idiot.
And he was trying to shoot birds.
Oh.
And he accidentally shot out the windows of the house across the street. And, you know, when the police came and questioned, Markham thinks, he later says that he thinks that the guy got in trouble for breaking the window and that the guy in turn sort of flipped on him and said, hey, this guy's got stolen Transformers. Mm. But from the officer's perspective, they said they called around town and that the St. Joseph's Light and Power were the ones who said, hey, yeah, we've got these Transformers that are missing. So conflicting stories there.
I think the lesson here is when you're building a time travel machine, don't have friends.
Don't let your buddy pick up your BB gun.
You need to be a loner.
As was typical in 1995, a listener of Art Bell's Coast to Coast AM radio broadcast faxed Bell the article about the young time machine inventor, which he then read on air.
I think it was the end of last week. Yes, it was. Saturday morning. I read you a story that was faxed to me by somebody in Columbia, Missouri. And I thought it incredible. The story is entitled, Kansas City Man Tries to Build Time Machine on Porch. Now, in case you don't remember the general tenure of the article, I'm going to remind you now. Kansas City Associated Press. When a Missouri factory worker set out to make a time machine on his back porch, the contraption he came up with was not completely off the mark, theoretically, according to scientists. With a high-voltage electrical transformer that Michael Markham had hooked up to two vertical metal rods would more likely have killed him or blown up his house than carried him into the past or future. Time travel, though enticingly possible in the mathematics of Einstein's theory of relativity, is not likely in the physical universe, they say.
they say.
Wait, so is that a photo of the guy? Like, he's amazing. He's 21, and he's, like, a balding redhead with, like, super long hair and, like, a kind of short cropped beard mustache and the whole lot. Looks great.
There are some conflicting reports on this. People who have claimed to be Mike Markham have later said that that picture is wrong, that it was somebody with the same name, but not actually him. But there is also, as I found out, there are a lot of people online who like to pretend that they are Mike Markham.
Yeah.
So it is really hard to, it was really hard to sort of parse what was real and or what came from him and what came from others. And so for, you know, the majority of the episode, I really try to stick to things that Mike said himself.
Mike, Madman Marcus's Multiverse of Madness.
He does say multiverse at a time when multiverse was not a sort of widely known phrase in some of his interviews.
Yeah, well, what do you think happened? I mean, a bunch of Markhams just started coming back, and there were just too many of them, and then they started all posting online.
So Art Bell himself is self-admittedly fascinated by the concept of time and time travel, and he took it upon himself to see if he could track the young man down. Art claims that at first he went through some of the show's affiliates hoping to locate Mike, but came up empty-handed. Eventually, Art was able to track Mike down through the phone book of all places, and after speaking with him briefly before the broadcast to ensure that he had the right guy, Bell invited Markham on his radio program dated April 15th, 1995. Only weeks before, Markham had finished serving a 60-day jail sentence for the theft of the 6 Transformers.
So 10 days for each Transformer?
Yeah, classic. Classic sentence.
Yeah, sounds like it.
I would say he should only get 50 if one of them was filled with pennies.
That's true, right? That could have paid for his bail.
Here's the clip.
Michael, are you there?
Yeah.
Good. First of all, had you heard that story before? The one I just read?
Yeah.
You've heard that, huh?
Yeah. It's like I'm, like, collecting clippings on it now.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
How old are you, Michael?
21.
21. Pretty young.
Yeah, very.
Now, let's go kind of back through the story like you and I did earlier today. This all began... Well, why did it? But that's a good question. I didn't even ask that. Why did this begin in the first place? What were you trying to do in the first place?
Originally, I just set out to make a fancy Jacob's ladder, and this was like what I got. What it turned out to be.
A lot of people don't know what a Jacob's ladder is. Tell them what it is.
Simply, in a nutshell, it's a like two metal rods with a spark going up in between it, and once it reaches the top, it starts back to the bottom again.
So. That kind of deal, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Like from a Frankenstein movie.
Yeah.
So, Jake, I noticed that you borrowed some of Art Bell's descriptions here in your own descriptions. Would you say you're a modern Art Bell? And would you say that Nori needs to be unseated?
All I can say is that pouring through all of these old interviews really made me appreciate Art and his commitment to remaining open-minded to, you know, even some of the most fantastic portions of this particular tale.
Yes, sir.
Markham explains that the whole ordeal began with a previous experiment that led him to believe he may have potentially stumbled upon the secret to time travel completely by accident. While some college-age kids like to trick out their pad with blacklight posters or lava lamps, Mike's idea of decoration materialized in the form of a homemade Jacob's ladder. After all, he had spent nearly 2 years majoring in electrical engineering at Rio Grande College in Columbia, Ohio, and continued to study it in his free time after he dropped out. But building the device wasn't quite as easy as he had hoped. The contraption was really touchy. If the rods were too close together, the spark wouldn't travel, and if they were too far apart, it wouldn't produce a spark at all. Mike realized he was only making matters worse by constantly adjusting the rods, and got the bright idea to try and heat the spark remotely via a laser from a compact disc player.
What?
Can't get more 90s than that.
I mean...
So what I did was, what I set out to do was, like, use a laser, like, use the heat from a laser to...
To get it started or something?
Yeah, like get it going by itself.
I see. The heat from a laser. That's interesting. So it would the heat from a laser would attract the spark, sort of?
Well, in a way, the heat from the laser lowers the resistance of the air is what it does.
Right. Gotcha.
Yeah.
So you got this laser by... How'd you get the laser?
Well, I practically made it from scratch. I took a CD laser and redid all the electronics in it. Kind of like reinforcing it, you'd say.
A CD laser. So you tore apart a CD player.
Yeah.
And so then you got the laser. Did it do what you wanted it to do, you know, start the spark?
Yeah, it's like had some other effects I didn't expect.
Well, and therein lies the story.
He sounds like every older brother from every friend
yes.
that I had in high school that opted, like, not to go to university.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
He's also probably lucky to be alive.
Well, we'll get to that.
Oh, boy.
Markham goes on to claim that his overclocked laser generated a lot of heat, a tenth of an amp, according to him, and that shortly after he powered the thing on, he began to notice what looked like a heat mirage floating just above the metal rods. According to Mike, when he leaned in for a closer look, he realized that the shimmering air had formed into a sphere. Now, like any amateur inventor who finally got their device working after much trial and error, Markham decided to take the next logical step, tossing a sheet metal screw through the center of the homemade vortex.
Oh.
See, I didn't know what this thing was, and it was like, I don't know, I just got the notion to throw a screw in it to see, like, what it did. Because I never saw anything like that before.
So,
kind of like testing it.
A screw, I guess, would be as good as anything else.
Yeah.
Mine might do that, too. All right, so you threw a screw into the...
circular thing.
Circular area.
Yeah, it's like I've talked to a couple of physicists. They call it a vortex, but...
All right, you threw it into what we'll call the vortex.
Yeah.
All right, what happened to the screw?
Well, I had this thing sitting on a table, right?
Yeah.
And I threw it in there, and I didn't see it after that.
It disappeared?
Yeah, roughly. I, like, did it three times. My laser burn up, so I knew it'd do that. I just didn't think it'd do it so quick.
So, okay, my God. I really hope he has some insulation, something. Things seem to burn and blow up quite a bit around him.
Maybe that's why his hair is in that strange, you know, baldness pattern at the front.
Yeah.
In later accounts of the story, Mike has some conflicting information. In this Art Bell interview, it sounds like he's claiming the screw disappeared completely, but in multiple other retellings, he said it disappeared for about half a second and then reappeared where it naturally would have landed on the table. Now, it could also very well be that the brightness of the spark caused Michael to lose track of the tiny object as it passed between the rods of the Jacob's ladder.
Yeah.
But whatever the reality, this event caused Madman Markham, as Art Bell affectionately named him, to seek out bigger transformers, stronger lasers, and maximum wattage.
No.
He rounded up a couple friends, 20-year-old Henry Rowan Jr. and 19-year-old Travis Troutwine. Real names. They were listed in the newspaper.
Yeah, I mean, his ancestors clearly sold Troutwine.
And offered them money in exchange for some help moving the transformers. According to St. Joseph's Light and Power Co., an employee had left the transformers outside of the King City facility in preparation for them to be moved to a different location. Either way, at the time, Markham knew he was doing something he probably shouldn't. Nevertheless, the heist crew was able to secure a pickup truck and load the six 300-pound transformers onto it one by one. The other two accomplices were arrested alongside Markham, and according to Sheriff Eugene Lupfer, neither Henry nor Travis shared Mike's vision of time travel. So he didn't tell the guys that what they were doing was illegal. He told them that they had, you know, that the transformers were sort of abandoned and were, you know, left on the side of the road, you know, for the trash to pick up.
This is classic Ricky from Trailer Park Boys. You have the two guys get the stuff like lawn furniture, move it to the curb, and then it's trash. So it's legal.
The employees pushed back on that and said that the transformers were, in fact, behind a chain link fence. But Markham argues this. He says it's not true because there is no way that they could have lifted the transformers over the fence. So take that for what you will. It was pretty obvious that all of the arresting officers got a pretty big kick out of Markham and his wild inventions. After all, the crime wasn't particularly severe, and Markham did spend about 2 months in jail on account of his foolishness. They all described Markham as an intelligent kid with a wild imagination, if maybe a little misguided. In what can only be described as a coast-to-coast Hall of Fame moment, one of the call-ins during Mike's first appearance on the show was none other than the arresting officer in his case, Tom Hampton.
Let's keep perusing the phone lines here and see what people have to say about us. It's really interesting. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Michael Markham. Hi.
Hi, this is Stanbury, Missouri.
Are you...
Arresting officer.
Oh, you are the...
Tom Hampton.
Hi, Mike. How you doing, boy?
Hey, you still got my diary, don't you?
You bet. Sit here on desk.
You are the arresting officer?
Yes, sir.
Well, I'll be darned.
Wow.
It's great to meet you. I don't know if it's great for Michael. Are you guys friends?
Well, are we friends, Mike?
Yeah.
Yeah, sort of.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
So Tom confirms many of the details in the local reporting, but pushes back on the claim that the town of Stanbury was angry with Markham and wanted him driven out on account of their electronics being fried. He does recall residents complaining of flickering lights in the two-block radius surrounding Markham's house, but doesn't recall any sort of serious blackouts. Towards the end of the brief interview, Art Bell asks the pair if there's anything they want to ask one another.
Well, this is quite a story. Officer, I'm absolutely glad you called Michael. Is there anything you'd like to ask him or the other way around?
Thanks, Buck.
Are you suggesting that Michael should not proceed to try this again?
I personally would, because of all the hazards involved. Electricity is a very dangerous toy.
Indeed.
And it's just one slip, and it's your last slip. I wouldn't do it.
Well,
I did like his electric cigarette lighter he had. You might have him explain that to you.
His electrical cigarette lighter?
Yes.
All right, officer.
Oh, the one I made out of the microwave?
Yeah.
Officer, thank you.
Incredible. The cops show up, they're lighting smokes off this guy's fucking repurposed microwave.
That irradiates you every time with microwave radiation?
To me, you guys, this is just about the best story I've ever heard. I mean, it's exactly that. You have these cops walking around looking at all of these, you know, harebrained sort of homemade gadgets. They're lighting their smokes off the microwave light. I mean, how fun.
Yeah, this is the small town America that we lost.
The majority of scientists and theoretical physicists who tracked the story had similar advice for young Mike, that he was far more likely to blow himself up than he was to travel through time. They did admit, however, that if time travel were to be possible, the 21-year-old kid from Ohio was kind of on the right track.
Mm-hmm.
In the circulating Associated Press article about Mike's ordeal, Roman Jacque, who conducted time travel research for the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, had this to say about Mike's endeavors.
Presumably, he decided that if he got enough electricity together, he could build a time machine, because there is the concept that if you're going to do it, it's going to require an enormous amount of energy. I believe there is not enough energy in the universe to do it. That's why it doesn't happen. My feeling is that whatever the mathematics of Einstein's equation may say, physics and common sense prohibit it. According to the mathematics of Einstein's theory of relativity, time and space are essentially equal to one another, allowing the theoretical possibility that one could move through time in the same way they would move through a room. If a person were somehow able to achieve the speed of light without their body imploding, technically, time would slow to a standstill for them in relation to time as it's measured on Earth. And if one was somehow able to move faster than the speed of light, time on Earth might actually start to move backwards. The only other plausible method would be to enter into a massive gravitational field, like ones found on the fringes of a black hole. As gravity in space increased exponentially, time would speed up significantly on planet Earth, and providing one could survive such a journey, I'm looking at you, Matthew McConaughey, they could return to Earth hundreds of years into the future. But judging by how things are going now, I wouldn't.
Interesting.
That being said, traveling to the future would be a much easier endeavor than traveling to the past. I mean, we already do it sometimes by accident. You know, have you guys ever laid down on the couch at, say, 2 in the afternoon on a Sunday, only to wake up 8 hours later not knowing what day or time it is? You might call that getting older, but it is technically time travel.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Relatively, sure.
Yes.
And when it comes to traveling into the past, the paradoxes alone would cause Einstein's equations to break up into a large debris field and burn up in our atmosphere. For example, say I used all of the Patreon money to purchase my own set of transformers. I perfect Mike's schematics and travel back in time to murder Julian. Mm. Now.
Wait, should this be bleeped out?
No, I'll allow it.
He'll allow it. Now, If I murder Julian, the QAA podcast never gets created, and I therefore have no Patreon money to buy the Transformers in the first place. Even prolific science fiction author Isaac Asimov was quoted as saying,
"It is precisely because time travel involves such fascinating paradoxes that we can conclude, even in the absence of other evidence, that time travel is impossible." See? This is saving my life. Thank God.
But despite all this, Madman Markham wasn't deterred. He'd only just gotten a tiny taste of time travel, and he endeavored to start again from scratch, legally this time. Michael gives out his telephone number at the end of the broadcast in the hopes that listeners can crowdfund his experiments, or at the very least, send him any Transformers they aren't using.
All their spare Transformers?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And boy, did they come through.
Just tons of small towns getting all their Transformers stolen by the local Marcuses.
Markham claims that shortly after the Coast to Coast appearance, he was slammed with phone calls, letters, and even people showing up at his doorstep, knocking on the door at all hours of the day. He was quoted in an article of Nexus Magazine about that time saying,
"People were knocking on my door day and night wanting to time travel. You would not believe how difficult it is explaining this to people who show up at your door wanting to go back to avert some tragic event X number of years ago. People tend to get their knowledge from too much Hollywood and not enough libraries." Yeah, that's so true.
I thought that this was actually kind of a sad and interesting detail about this story is that, you know, a lot of people showed up basically saying, "Hey, can you take me back in time? Because, like, I need to fix the past."
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Eventually, the publicity became so intense that Mike had to pick up and move out of town. It was a moot point, however, as Mike's landlord had also evicted him from his St. Joseph's apartment for causing too much havoc with the building's electricity. He had also been fired from his job. According to him, after his arrest and the story became public, Mike's boss believed that his extracurricular work had contaminated the workspace with PCBs, and he was promptly let go.
Wait, with PCBs? What's that?
It's like basically, I believe it's chemicals that are given off when you disassemble electronics or some kind of hazardous chemical that
is contaminating the cardboard box factory.
Yeah, that's something, you know, it's kind of murky, but there was, basically it sounded like they were looking for any reason to sort of let him go.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mike packed up as much gear as he could and moved to Kansas City, but not before accepting a couple of capacitors and heavy gauge cable that folks were keen to donate to him. Mike admits that most of the stuff he had been sent wasn't even usable for his experiments, but he felt bad turning down the gifts. Shortly after the relocation, Madman Markham had built a new, more legit, and much bigger operation than he was able to in Stanbury. One admirer had given him a warehouse in which to rebuild his machine.
Whoa.
Others had donated transformers as well as massive generators so as not to get on the nerves of the power companies. His new machine had ditched the Jacobs ladder rods for two large metal cylinders insulated with ground copper mesh and 24 insulated rings surrounding the outside. The time machine stood so high off the ground, about 50 feet, that Mike was going to use a cherry picker to jump into it.
He wants to become the screw. He wants to jump into the vortex.
If you go back and you listen to these Art Bell interviews, Mike goes into a lot of technical detail about what this machine looks like, how it works. But essentially, from what I can gather, is it's and even Art Bell starts calling it the Stargate. This thing is like seven rings sort of stacked on top of one another. And inside each of these rings are like magnets, essentially 24 on each ring. So 120 something in total. And it's like a cylinder within a cylinder. And it had to be hoisted 35 feet up off of the ground. There couldn't be anything underneath it because the heat from the electricity would burn anything. So he couldn't put any mattresses down or anything like that. I mean, it almost sort of reminds me not of the actual Stargate itself, but the sort of transporter that they use to move from the inside the pyramid up to the ship, these sort of rings of light that are stacked on top of one another, just to give you guys a little bit of a visual.
I mean, it also sounds a little like Event Horizon. That
ball with
the rings that rotate around, and he's going to go inside and then come back and eat people's faces off.
I mean, if the screw like traveled to the spot where it would fall, wouldn't he just fall from 35 feet?
We're going to get to that, Julian. Oh, don't you worry. In December of 1996, over a year after his first appearance, Madman Markham once again called his friend Art Bell to tell him that the time machine, was 30 days away from completion.
Art, I have 30 days to live.
After catching his audience up to speed with Mike's initial story, Art begins to interview him about the improvements made to his existing design.
You are once again, you said there are new developments. You have...
Basically, I've improved it since then.
You improved it?
Yeah. Now, instead of lasers, I use a revolving magnetic field. See, basically, I figured out what I did. It's basically a vortex of electrical energy.
Now, you're going to use, wait a minute, a revolving magnetic field?
Yeah, basically it's a circle of electromagnets. Basically, 24 around, it's seven circles stacked one on top of the other. In each circle, there's 24 electromagnets.
Wow! Really?
Yeah.
And you power?
Probably, this one's getting a little bit more complicated.
Oh, no, this is really cool. Now,
I feel like Art should be telling him to exercise more caution.
There's a lot of that. I mean, they talk, you know, kind of ad nauseum about, okay, you know, whether or not you should do this. Are you really going to do it? What kind of tests are you going to perform? But what's really awesome about this whole thing is that, you know, from the first interview up until this point, you know, Art is sort of skeptical. And as Michael begins telling him more about the machine and about the electronics and about the build, you can see Art just get more and more excited and eventually just kind of get like totally pilled on this whole thing, to the point where, you know, it's almost, he's almost encouraging Mike to keep going and sort of go through with this.
Yeah.
So Mike claims over the air that he's measured the electric field in the center of the machine, precisely the place he'd eventually be stepping into or jumping into, at 3 million volts at about 1 amp. Now, even though the amps are lower than, say, the electric chair, which uses about 2,000 volts at, you know, 7 to 12 amps, Mike acknowledges that the amount of electricity would certainly kill him if he didn't end up traveling through time.
Oh, no.
He also agrees to let Art come and videotape it, whatever the outcome, which pleases Art Bell very much.
Oh, no.
So it's a snuff movie.
Yeah.
It's so funny because there's a bunch of great, you know, sort of back and forth that they have where Art says, you know, he goes, you know, I'll come and videotape it. And, you know, we could potentially be recording, you know, one of the most important scientific discoveries of our time.
Yeah.
And if not, it would be a fantastic memorial video for young man Mike Markham. You know, he keeps calling it a memorial video and that it would be shared widely. And,
oh my God. Yeah. The invention of the air fryer.
After this point, we get a glimpse into Markham's personal life for the first time. Art Bell asks him if his family or his friends are concerned for Mike's safety and sanity. To me, this is one of the most powerful moments in either of Mike's coast-to-coast appearances.
Now, surely your parents and your friends... Where are your parents?
I haven't talked to them in, like 10 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Then friends, what do they say to you? Are they concerned about you?
Some of them think I'm full of crap. Some think I'm crazy. The others are, like, kind of worried.
Have you wondered about whether you're crazy yourself? Now, I'm not saying you're crazy, and far from it, because actually I really think you're working in a fascinating area, frankly, and I might be tempted to do something like that myself. But have you ever considered your own sanity? And said to yourself, Mike, I might be nuts.
Well,
Is that a yes?
I never really considered it, really.
Never thought about it?
No.
So?
Basically, I take that back. I kind of have, but I just figured, well, if I am, if not, I'm not.
Que sera, sera, sera.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Que sera, sera.
I just thought this moment was, like, so powerful. There's this, like, second where it really feels like you're hearing him kind of grapple with this question, am I nuts? And his, you know, he sort of lands on this place of like, well, actually, you know, no, I never really thought about it. And I don't know. I don't know how true that is. And then he sort of says, you know, well, if I am, I am. If I'm not, I'm not. I don't know. There's just something sort of interesting here. Even though in the interview, Mike says he's about 30 days away from the machine's completion, he wouldn't do his first human trial until 2 years later in 1998, while I was in high school somewhere in Illinois, just one state over. Mike positioned himself on top of the cherry picker, the machine cranked to the max, and in front of 25 or 30 people, folks who had donated either money or equipment, he jumped into the cylinder. and vanished.
What?
Art Bell, who had been following the story closely and was awaiting Mike's invitation to come film its conclusion, couldn't find the guy. If there was a missing persons report filed, nobody could find it. The story and Mike simply went away. For years after, listeners continued to call in asking questions about the madman. Had Art heard from him? Had anyone? Had the kid really found a way to travel through time? In Markham's last interview, he had joked that the shrink he had to see under the terms of his parole had called him delusional. Maybe the whole thing was an elaborate hoax, and eventually Markham got bored and moved on. It was a fact that he had been sent tons of electrical gear from Bell's listeners, and furthermore, once he'd built up a little bit of fame, people familiar with his story wanted to donate equipment of their own. Maybe Mike figured he was copper rich and sold all the spare equipment to start over somewhere else. After all, he was only 24 at the time of his disappearance. Conspiracy theories began to creep in over the years about Mad Mike and his time travel experiments. There were rumors he'd been run out of St. Joseph's for throwing a cat through one of his machines.
Jesus.
At one point, a listener called into Art Bell's show, claiming to have read an article discussing an odd case from the 1930s where an unidentified body had washed up onto a beach in California inside of a metal tube with a strange device matching the description of a cell phone lying nearby. Researchers have since pointed out that there were very few John Does recorded in California during the 1930s, and none of the records match the age that Markham would have been. There was a case in the 50s where train workers in Burbank, California found a badly decomposed body under a stack of metal tubes in one of the train cars. And another story from 1950 in Virginia where an unidentified young man washed up, badly decomposed, on the shore of the bay. Perhaps somebody misremembered these stories and combined them. As far as Art Bell was concerned regarding the case of one of his favorite coast-to-coast guests, he was sure Mike had killed himself. But maybe, just maybe, Mike had actually done it. And then, the unexpected happened. Early in September of 2015, 20 years after Mike Markham's first appearance on Coast to Coast, he contacted Art one last time. It's an incredible episode, and while there were, I'm sure, thousands of new listeners hearing about the madman for the first time, many of Art's original listeners who had been tracking the story for two decades were finally going to get to hear whether Markham's machine had actually worked. The last time the two had spoken, Mike claimed to have had most of the machine built and had yet to send a living organism through his Stargate, as Bell referred to it. And so, 20 years later, Mike's tale picks up right where we left off.
Let's continue. So the big test comes, all these people are watching, you fire the generators up, you've got the incoming power, and what was your test going to be?
Well, at first I was tossing basically hamsters and guinea pigs in it. So
really,
God,
yeah,
living things.
With small things before. I'm not just going. I mean, at the time I had basically a more like almost infinite risk tolerance, I guess you could put it.
Infinite risk tolerance. Well, anyway, okay. So hamsters and guinea pigs. How did they fare? I mean, what happened to them?
Well, basically, instead of the original experiment where I made a screw disappear for half a second, well, right. These guinea pigs, they were disappearing for anywhere from 1 to 2 minutes, and they were basically either 100 between 50 and 150 yards east or west of where they disappeared.
East or west of the point of disappearance, but not north or south?
Nope. And basically, as far as why, I'm thinking has something to do with the Earth's magnetic field. That's the only thing I can think of. So,
but did he not say if they were, you know, like fried to a crisp?
No, they all lived. They all lived, according to him. They would appear anywhere, from 15 yards to 120 yards, either east or west.
But he was throwing them, it was like 30 feet in the air, right?
Mm-hmm. Mike estimates that he sent over 200 objects and animals through the large machine, and each time they would appear either east or west of the warehouse, outside in the parking lot. He couldn't be sure exactly how long the guinea pigs were gone, because oftentimes it took a couple hours to locate them after they'd been sent through the machine. Mike claims that these experiments were recorded on video camera by his numerous donors who were present for nearly all of the live tests. When asked why they didn't release the videos, Mike explains that the group was very secretive about the success of the machine.
Mm-hmm.
There had been several instances where Mike was contacted by folks begging him to take them with him when he jumped into the vortex. People Mike believes just wanted to kill themselves and saw this as a spectacular way to go out. Some believe the government would swoop in and shut them down the moment word broke of its capabilities, or worse. It's a tricky thing to be on the cusp of proving that everything we know about the universe is about to be turned upside down. After 200 successful tests, well, 199, Mike admits the only object they never found was a grapefruit they'd tossed in. But Mike was ready to jump into the machine himself. He had a number of concerns. One, of course, was that he'd be vaporized instantly. Mm-hmm. This seemed to be the most probable outcome, according to the handful of physicists he'd consulted with over the years. But there were other, much more terrifying consequences, like appearing in the middle of space or inside a concrete block. Mike admits that he couldn't really think too hard about it, or he probably would have talked himself into aborting the whole thing. There was also the possibility that nothing would happen, and Mike would fall 60 feet to the concrete floor and break his legs. Despite all of this, Mike Madman Markham jumped into his homemade time machine.
All right, so you climb up on the bucket, and you jump. And then what?
Well, long story short, it feels like I got hit with a flashbang, and I wake up, and I'm 800 miles east of there, and 2 years later. So that's basically, ain't no other way to put it.
800 miles east, and 2 years gone.
Yeah, well, basically what I did, I more or less, it's not very scientific in hindsight, but what I did is cranked everything max, basically to the max. So, because I wanted to make sure that I actually leap because, rather than hit the floor. So.
So, when you woke up, did you have memory of what you had done? I mean, what condition were you in when...
When I came through the other side, so to speak, I had total amnesia. EMF and all that magnetism basically messed with my brain, so...
I'm sure it would.
This seems like the shittiest outcome. You just lose 2 years of your life?
Yeah. So Mike claims that he awoke in a field in the middle of nowhere. He couldn't remember his name or anything about the time machine, Art Bell, or the 25 or so people that had just watched him vanish into thin air. He began to walk. Mike figured if he picked a direction and stuck to it, he'd eventually get to a road. And if he got to a road, he could begin to unravel just where the hell he was and when. Markham didn't have any ID or notes or money, credit cards, anything on his person. One might ask, why on earth would someone travel into the future so woefully unprepared? But then again, according to Mike, everything he had sent through previously had reappeared within a couple dozen yards of the machine. Maybe it was the wattage or his mass that had altered his trajectory. His name came back to him within a couple hours, and according to Mike, he ended up in a homeless shelter near Fairfield, Ohio. Now, oddly enough, if you go into Google Maps and fetch directions from St. Joseph's, Missouri to Fairfield, Ohio, Fairfield is nearly 700 miles directly east of St. Joseph's.
Dun dun.
Mike didn't learn it was the year 2000 until the next morning, when newspapers were passed around the shelter and he was finally able to see the date. He was quite shocked to learn that he had traveled over 2 years into the future. He says one of the first things he did was went to the local library to see if a missing persons report had been filed or death certificate had been issued, but he couldn't find any. He'd wanted to call his family or even his donors, but he couldn't remember any of their names or telephone numbers. It was as if he had been in a coma for 2 years and returned to a world where he no longer existed. He wondered if perhaps the string theorists had been right all along, that Mike had jumped into an alternate dimension. All he could think to do was try and find a way back to his warehouse in Missouri. According to Mike, he began to work odd jobs around town while staying at the shelter until he had finally saved up enough money for a Greyhound ticket back home. When he arrived at the warehouse, all of his stuff was gone, and a new tenant was renting there. All of Markham's notes, equipment, and videotapes were simply gone. He thought maybe he could call the owner of the building, but as Mike tells it, he couldn't really remember his name. He was heartbroken. He had no money, no place to live, and worst of all, no proof that he had solved the mystery of time travel. There was nothing really to do except start over. And of course, what if the time machine? Had it been locked away in some government facility next to the smoldering Ark of the Covenant? Or did the landlord merely have it hauled to a junkyard and stripped for scrap? If Mike had the type of equipment he claimed to have, someone could have made quite a bit of money off of it. There's still so many questions I want answered. What did Mike's family say after no contact for 2 years? Why wasn't there a missing persons report filed? Was Mike so disconnected from his family or friends that it wasn't anything out of the ordinary for him to disappear like this? And what about the 25 donors who had witnessed all of the experiments and ultimately watched Mike jump through? Maybe they thought he had been vaporized, and when he didn't end up in the parking lot, they ran for fear of being implicated in his death. I was really hoping that one of them would call in on that last broadcast. You know, like the arresting officer, Tom Hampton had during the first one. And I don't know why this is making me so emotional. Maybe because if, you know, one of these people had called in, you know, and said, hey, I was there, you know, I saw it, we've been looking for you. Then maybe the whole thing doesn't become this, like, very sort of sad kind of mental health thing. And what's fascinating about it, though, is that Mike doesn't seem sad. He doesn't seem, you know, when we check in with him, you know, 20 years later, you know, he doesn't have the emotion maybe that I'm sort of ascribing to this.
Well, yeah, and just the idea that you matter so little to people at some point that 2 years gone doesn't even register.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Jake, if you disappeared, you would matter to me.
Oh, I know. I don't have the patience to, you know, build something like this or the technical know-how.
You saved my life, brother. I love you.
I love you guys too.
No.
And it's just fascinating. It's because, like, we know that Mike was arrested for stealing 6 Transformers. We know the police have written accounts of at least 2 of his contraptions, but the rest is anyone's guess. Perhaps the thing that pills me so hard about this time travel story is how boring and sad it is. There is no grift. Why hasn't Mike become a content creator, you know? Like, like done all the rounds on all of the podcasts, you know, become a time travel whistleblower. You know, in this day and age, a guy with a story like Mike's could really carve out a nice niche for himself amongst the droves of free energy believers or time travel enthusiasts.
Yeah, I mean, we could have seen him at the Conscious Life Expo in Los Angeles at his own booth.
I wouldn't get too close to that booth.
Your hair might stand on it.
A lot of PCBs.
A lot of PCBs, and I don't know, man. I don't want to get sucked into this time travel machine. If you just lose 2 years, like, that's a raw deal for me.
In his final interview with Art Bell, tons of callers, and Bell himself, encouraged Mike to cash in on his incredible story. A movie deal, a book. One caller even suggests starting a Patreon.
Oh my God.
But Mike doesn't seem all that interested. He mentions he's got a YouTube account, but he thinks it was hacked.
By his past self?
I don't know. When asked if he would build again, his response is pretty neutral. If I can build it, I'll build it, I guess. So I do wonder if we'll ever hear from Madman Mike again. With today's technology, I imagine he could build something much more sophisticated than he was able to in 1998. On the other hand, perhaps the dark side of celebrity and the trauma that accompanies time travel was enough to just make him call it quits. Maybe he just wants to live out the rest of his life in peace, like a normal 49-year-old. Or, in Mike's case, 47. So, that is the incredible story of Mike Markham, the absolute madman who traveled to the year 2000. But before we wrap up here, I do want to share one more thing. In 1998, a group of Russian UFO researchers were doing an excavation at a crashed meteor site outside of Moscow, and while sifting through the rocks, they found something quite interesting. An object that closely resembled a sheet metal screw was found embedded inside of a rock, tested to be over 300 million years old. Now, a number of scientists pushed back on the claim, explaining that the object is much more likely a fossilized crinoid, a prehistoric sea creature. But those who have been closely following Mike Markham's story now for over 20 years wonder if perhaps this is where Mike's screw ended up.
It's a beautiful story.
Yeah. It also reminds me a little of that other Mad Mike, Mike Hughes, who wanted to prove the Earth was flat, and he built that homemade rocket and ended up killing himself, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what? This doesn't have a sad ending.
Yeah.
It's actually just kind of it's kind of there. But, you know, even Art Bell in later interviews said that this was one of his favorite guests of all time. You know, he looks back on these conversations with Michael as like some of the greatest in, you know, of his career.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I hope you enjoyed it.
I'm going to travel to like a few days from now and give you a big hug.
And a cookie.
Yeah, no, I'm fine. I just, yeah, I think that is, you know, you spend a lot of time wondering, you know, what's real and what's not. And it seems, yeah, like the most plausible sort of explanation is that, yeah, you know, Mike had experienced some kind of, you know, severe sort of mental episode. And the fact that, yeah, that he was able to disappear for 2 years and that was kind of normal. You know, he had said earlier in the interview that he hadn't talked to his parents in 10 years. And I don't know, I just kind of feel sad for him and curious about, you know, how close he really got. How much of this, you know, this larger machine really had been built?
Yeah, and if he had even built any of it.
If he had built any of it.
If he's still alive, he could get in touch with you, right?
He could, yeah, if he wanted to. I would be more than open to it. Who knows? Perhaps he's got a Google search alert for his name. You know, he said that after he traveled through time, he, you know, Googled himself and found all of these sort of amazing conspiracy theories about him. You know, he says the guy in the 1930s tube, he doesn't know who that is. Maybe it's like a prestige situation where a clone of himself was created. I don't know. And he also says the cat story was bullshit. He never put a cat through the machine. Only hamsters, guinea pigs, and himself. But who knows? Maybe he still got that Google search alert running, and he'll come across this episode. And Mike, please feel free to reach out if you feel so inclined. And if not, I hope you're well. You have been listening to The Spectral Voyager, a special miniseries brought to you by the folks at QAA. Thank you to everybody for subscribing, because it allows us to keep making strange new shows like this one. So until next time, farewell from beyond the veil.